Welcome back to Visiting Professors. The second part of our program features the perspectives of Dr. Kathy Miller from Simon Cancer Center in Indianapolis, Indiana, who visited the practice of Dr. Leila Agrawal in Louisville, Kentucky. I met with both of them after they met with Dr. Agrawal's patients with ER-positive metastatic breast cancer. And to begin, Dr. Agrawal presented a 70-year-old woman from her practice who in 1993 began 5 years of adjuvant tamoxifen after surgery for an ER-positive HER2-negative tumor, but then in 2011 was diagnosed with a second ER-positive cancer and received 5 years of anastrozole. After being off treatment in November 2017, the patient was discovered to have widespread metastatic disease to the lungs, bone, and liver. Dr. Agrawal began the discussion.
So I had treated the patient with letrozole and palbociclib for initial treatment of her metastatic cancer. We went for about 3 to 4 months of treatment, and I obtained another set of surveillance scans with a CT of the chest and pelvis and a bone scan. And to my surprise, it showed progression of disease in her liver and lungs. So the bone scan appeared stable, but on the CAT scan, they described new innumerable subcentimeter liver lesions, whereas before she only had 2 subcentimeter liver lesions seen. And in the lungs, they reported slight progression of the pulmonary nodules that were previously seen.
So is she aware of what the scan showed?
I had met her earlier in the week and given her the news. And right when I gave her the results, she said to me, well, I wonder if my cancer is somehow resistant to this treatment, which is exactly what I was about to mention to her.
And the patient herself also brought up, should we biopsy my tumor to see what's happened and to see what's changed? I think partly hoping that that might point to therapies that might be more effective for her, but also just part of her trying to make sense of this and trying to understand what's happening to her in almost a more logical way.
So, Leila, any questions you have for Kathy about this case?
There's a few questions I have about her case. First of all, the second cancer, when she was diagnosed in 2011, had a low oncotype recurrence score, which I wondered whether somehow this recurrence could be different than her initial cancer at that time, or may not have been eradicated by her adjuvant aromatase inhibitor treatment, especially once there was progression so soon after starting her metastatic treatment. So one thing that I was wondering about was whether an estrogen receptor mutation may explain this clinical course.
So I think that's actually an excellent reason to think about rebiopsying her tumor. Even though we've all been impressed by the improvement in response and progression-free survival by adding the cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitors, they don't work for everybody. Mm-hmm. And hormone therapy doesn't work for everybody. And there are many mechanisms of resistance. In this case, particularly since she has progressed relatively soon after having a pretty long disease-free interval, I think a biopsy to see, are there known resistance mechanisms, some of the ER-activating mutations that might point to different hormone therapies rather than immediately changing to chemotherapy? Mm-hmm. Is this growth of a subclone that is estrogen negative as an explanation? Are all excellent reasons to do a biopsy. The good news is that while her scans have progressed, she really feels perfectly fine. So that, in my mind, means there is not an emergent need that she has to switch to chemotherapy as her next choice, or that there isn't time to get a biopsy, change to different hormone therapy, see how that works for her, what the biopsy results might point you to before changing her to therapy that might bring a lot bigger toxicity burden.
Mm-hmm. So I have sent her liver biopsy off for Foundation One testing to look at the estrogen receptor, among other things, in this particular case. And I've switched her therapy to fulvestrant, and I have continued on her palbociclib while awaiting these results, which I expect in about 3 weeks. And then the next final decision will be made looking at those.
And we talked a little bit about continuing her palbociclib. So there's some, I think, legitimate questions. Is that first scan, is this really progression on combination? Or was this just minor progression while she was on hormone therapy alone, and we don't yet have a really good evaluation of the combination for her?
In this particular patient's case, the two scans were done on different machines at different facilities. So that introduced at least enough question in my mind if maybe this just wasn't visualized fully on the initial scan to continue.
Kathy, Layla mentioned this issue of estrogen receptor mutations. Can you explain a little bit about what those are and right now what we know about what it means?
So there are several activating estrogen receptor mutations that have been identified. They were actually first identified by Suzanne Fuqua many years ago. With that first report, many laboratories went back to their primary tumor samples, assayed those to see if they could identify or validate those findings. And they really rarely found estrogen receptor mutations in the primary tumors. We just in the last year or so have seen additional pathologic correlative studies focusing on metastatic tumors, those that have become resistant to at least an initial hormone therapy. And in that setting, the frequency of those activating mutations is really quite a bit different. Those tumors, at least from the somewhat limited data that we have so far, are a bit less likely to benefit from simply lowering estrogen levels with an AI because the receptor itself is independently kind of stuck in the on position. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't need the ligand to bind to trigger signaling, but perhaps more likely to benefit or just as likely to benefit as those that don't have an activating mutation from things like fulvestrant or even a SERM. So it'll be fascinating to see, given this potentially rapid progression on an AI, if she does have an activating mutation and if fulvestrant might allow her to still benefit from hormone therapy. We're learning a bit more about some of the downstream signaling pathways that might also allow us to restore estrogen sensitivity in those patients. Those drugs, things like the BET domain inhibitors, are still in clinical trials, but I think give real hope for the ability to even further extend the benefits of hormone therapy for our patients.
Did you say MET inhibitors?
No, the bromodomain inhibitors.
Oh, these are for patients with these mutations?
So they're being studied in patients with endocrine resistance, and there is at least some preclinical suggestion that they might also be useful in patients who have activating mutations. Now, they're still in clinical trials, so I think we still have a lot to learn about how effective they are and in which patients they might be most effective. I think what has been most exciting for me over the years is we continue to find ways to make use of hormone therapy for our patients. And while hormone therapy certainly have some toxicity, things like the cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitors and mTOR inhibitors bring other toxicity to our patients, for many of our patients, the toxicity is substantially less than chemotherapy. So all of these things that allow us to take advantage of hormones for a longer period of time, I think will have real benefits for our patients.
Could I ask that maybe just to take a step back, Kathy, and to have you talk a little bit about your vision, maybe the way you explain to fellows, of how endocrine therapy actually works in breast cancer, how the different endocrine treatments cause responses, and then why you see resistance developing after, you know, many patients do respond.
So I can tackle the first part of that. So I think this is actually an important thing for us all to remember, and it's actually something we talked about with this particular patient. I certainly did not see this one with any of Dr. Agarwal's patients, but I think we sometimes are still guilty of telling patients whose tumors progress on their first hormone therapy that they're now resistant to endocrine therapy and they need to move on to chemo. And we have many different hormone therapies with very different mechanisms of action. So we should not consider that resistance to hormone therapy. We should consider that resistance to a specific drug and a specific mechanism of action. So the simple way that I often explain the differences in the mechanism of action to patients and to medical students is that if you imagine somebody has a hose and they're spraying water on you and you want to not get wet, you could put on a rain hat and a raincoat and galoshes. That's sort of the tamoxifen approach. It's still raining, but you're not getting wet. you could think about turning off the water or turning down the water. That would be something like an aromatase inhibitor that blocks the flow of estrogen or blocks production of estrogen. Fulvestrant, in some ways, is a little bit like a super raincoat. We put you in a plastic bag in addition to your raincoat because it more fully blocks the effects of estrogen. And trying to explain in that analogy how things like megestrol works doesn't work very well. So I haven't figured out how to fit that into the analogy. But they're all effective, and they can be effective sequentially. Talking about resistance also gets a little bit tricky because we found many ways that tumors can become resistant. This is easier to study in the laboratory than it is in patients. So we've talked a bit about the estrogen receptor activating mutations. Essentially, the receptor is continuously signaling whether estrogen is present or not. But we also know that sometimes tumors might increase the expression of other growth factors. They have found another way to drive growth forward, even if the estrogen receptor signaling is attenuated. And those tumors might be the ones that more likely benefit from an mTOR inhibitor, since that is such a common pathway for other growth factor signaling effects.
Can you kind of put, you're so good, Kathy, at trying to explain things in ways that people can understand why it is that you see the benefit from adding either an mTOR inhibitor or a CDK4/6 inhibitor. I can't get too far beyond being downstream and upstream, and that these things are somehow activated and bypass the normal mechanism. Can you make it more scientific for me?
I'm better at making it less scientific because I spend so much time trying to explain these things to patients who are not scientists. So mTOR used to be considered sort of a common regulator, a common second messenger for tumors. So multiple growth factor receptors, whether they're nuclear receptors like the estrogen receptor, or cell surface receptors like HER2, signaling from those growth factor receptors flows through the mTOR pathway. From mTOR, I think of this as splitting into two pathways, one of which stimulates the cells to grow, the other of which prevents the cells from dying. So blocking mTOR might be able to block the effects of multiple growth factor inputs because it is a common final pathway. Now, the cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitors are a bit different, and that challenges us to think about the fact that many of our therapies may not directly kill a cancer cell, but they cause injury or damage to a cancer cell that can't be repaired. And what should happen in normal cells is that should trigger the cells to die. So the way I often explain this to patients is that for many of us, before we think about having children, we do a bit of a survey. How is our personal life? How's the relationship? How healthy are we? What's the bank account look like? Is this a good time for us to reproduce? You can think of cells doing the same thing before a healthy cell is going to reproduce and begin that S phase of the cell cycle. It does a similar survey, any damage, any problems we need to fix. And if it finds problems, it should prevent the cell from moving forward into the S phase until those problems are fixed. And if it can't be fixed, it should trigger the cell to die. Now, if you are a cancer cell, that's a problem. Cancer cells have lots of mistakes, lots of mutations. If that checkpoint worked properly, it would prevent them from proceeding. So cancer cells frequently have disabled that checkpoint. So the cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitors essentially restore the normal function of that checkpoint and make it easier for the damage that our therapies induce to then trigger death of those cells, or at least stop their proliferation.
So another sort of global question I wanted to ask you, Kathy, in terms of endocrine therapy in general, relates to the issue of selection of a CDK4/6 inhibitor. Right now, the algorithm seems to be that generally CDK inhibitors are used before mTOR inhibitors, specifically everolimus. But then the question is, which one? Could you talk a little bit, Kathy, about your view on what we know about the three approved agents and how you go about selecting which one to use and in what situation?
So there are now three. In order of their approval, palbociclib, then ribociclib, most recently abemaciclib. Like a lot of our molecularly targeted drugs, they're fairly dirty drugs. So while the goal, and we think that the cyclin-dependent kinases 4 and 6 are the two most important for the activity, that was the goal, to inhibit those, they actually inhibit a fair spectrum of cyclin-dependent kinases. If you look at the spectrum of activity, palbociclib and ribociclib are pretty similar, and I think that plays out in their toxicity profiles. They are fairly similar. Abemaciclib has a slightly different spectrum of the CDKs that it inhibits and with different potencies. And we see that in its toxicity profile. Its toxicity profile is a bit more weighted towards GI toxicity and a bit less of the myelosuppression. Now, we see perhaps some differences in their activity as well. So palbociclib and ribociclib have very little, if any, meaningful single-agent activity. We do see single-agent activity with abemaciclib, and we see that in its approval. So they're all approved in combination with endocrine therapy. Abemaciclib is the only one that also has an approval as monotherapy. If we're talking about first-line use in combination with endocrine therapy, I don't think we have any clinical data that allows us to pick one over the other. They've not been directly compared. When I look at their activity in those frontline trials, their activity looks very, very similar to me. There are some differences in their toxicity profile, and that may be a reason to choose one over the other for some patients. I have to admit, I am very much a creature of habit. I'm quite willing to change my habits if you show me data that says there's a better way. Just showing me another way is not a reason for me to learn a different dosing strategy. And particularly for these drugs, the patient education, the nursing education, understanding the monitoring and the potential toxicities are so crucial. I wouldn't quibble with someone who says I started using palbo. I'm comfortable with that. My nurses are comfortable with that. Everybody understands what we need to do. I don't see any data at this point that would challenge the use of any of those agents above another.
There is another difference between abema and the other two, which is the schedule, in that abema is given continuously. And I have heard people say there's a sort of theoretical efficacy advantage of continuous therapy. Maybe some laboratory stuff suggested it. But also from a patient, point of view, that it's easier to, educate a patient to take medicine on a daily basis. Any thoughts there about the schedule and what that means, Kathy?
I can make two different arguments there, Neil. They, at this point, have not been compared in any setting in people, to my knowledge. I think for some patients, we might think taking a pill daily might facilitate compliance and be a bit easier to explain. But for some patients, that might mean that they never get a break of taking additional pills and they never get a break of whatever toxicity burden comes with that drug. So I understand the theoretical differences. I think it's just hard for me to know how those will pan out in patients. We certainly have other drugs. The aromatase inhibitors are actually a perfect example. In laboratory settings, letrozole gives you greater inhibition of aromatase and greater inhibition of estrogen conversion than anastrozole does. But in the clinic, that laboratory difference was meaningless.
So one other question I want to ask you is the issue of CNS activity, Kathy. We do see patients, obviously, with brain mets where this is a consideration. I have heard it said, I don't know how hard the data is, there's more supporting data with abemaciclib. Is that the case?
I think we don't know yet. I think what we have at this point is more a small collection of anecdotes than good data that should impact clinical practice. This certainly is a consideration, though estrogen receptor positive tumors are somewhat less likely to involve the brain than triple negative disease or hormone positive disease. That's a good thing for our patients. I think it makes it harder for us to get good data in this. For the majority of our patients with estrogen positive disease, at the point they develop CNS involvement, if that is going to be a part of their natural history, it tends to be quite late. It tends to be often after they've moved on from hormone therapy. So I'm not convinced that we have enough clinical data to really make recommendations.
You also, Kathy, mentioned monotherapy. Is there any clinical situation where you would use CDK monotherapy? Have you used it?
So I actually have a patient in my practice who is on abemaciclib monotherapy right now. She is a woman who's had metastatic disease for quite a long time. She was on tamoxifen in the adjuvant setting, treated elsewhere at that point, but describes that as perhaps the most awful thing she ever did, and is very clear that she will not ever consider going back on tamoxifen again. She had really striking aromatase inhibitor musculoskeletal toxicity when she was on an AI at the time of her initial diagnosis of metastatic disease. We tried two different AIs, and it really was intolerable for her. She's been on fulvestrant with excellent control of her disease, had been on fulvestrant for about 8 years when she started developing an allergy to the injections with just intense itching that initially was just after an injection and would abate, became more continuous. We stopped her fulvestrant for several months and the itching gradually got better. I tried to put her back on the fulvestrant, and within a month, she was itching horribly again, so that was really no longer tolerable. She was then actually observed off therapy for about a year until her disease progressed. She's never had a cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitor. She's never had an mTOR inhibitor because her disease had been under control with fulvestrant during the time those drugs came into our therapeutic options. Abemaciclib seemed like a really good option for her. So she just started the abemaciclib about 2 months ago, just started therapy. So I don't know yet how well it's working for her. But that's one very good example of someone who might have had the therapies in combination or had the hormone therapies that you would use in combination as monotherapy and is now progressing as a way of taking advantage of that.
That's a really fascinating case. Has she had any tolerability issues, any GI problems with the abemaciclib?
You know, she has constantly struggled with constipation. So she's had very mild nausea that she does not really describe as very troublesome. Her version of diarrhea is she has less constipation. So she thinks that's a bit of a bonus. She does note some fatigue. There's a lot going on in her life. Her daughter just got engaged and they're in the process of moving. So it's a little tough to know how much of her fatigue is drug related. But so far it has gone quite well for her.
That's really interesting. What about this issue of continuing a CDK inhibitor on disease progression or using a second CDK inhibitor after progression? For example, abemaciclib monotherapy after progression on one of the other two?
So all really good scientific questions and really good practical clinical questions for which we have zero clinical data. So I have not done that outside of a trial in any of my patients because I just simply don't know how effective that would be for them. I do think someone who had more rapid progression but had delays in starting a CDK4/6 inhibitor because of working through insurance approvals and getting access to the drug, where you wonder if they really got enough of the drug to know if they truly progressed on the combination, is a reason to not be so quick to stop therapy. But I certainly don't think we have any data at this point to say this is like HER2, where you should clearly continue HER2-targeted therapy of some sort and just swap in a different dance partner.
Layla, any general questions you'd like to ask Kathy about this whole issue of hormone therapy?
Do you think it's reasonable to switch from one to a different one based on tolerance? If I had a patient who was really having limiting neutropenia or anemia on palbociclib, for example, is there a role for switching to an alternate CDK4/6 inhibitor?
So I think actually at this point, that is the only reason where it's reasonable to switch from one to another. If you have someone whose disease seems to be doing well on the first CDK4/6 inhibitor that you start them on, but they're having toxicity that you really think is prohibitive, there is a CDK4/6 inhibitor with a different toxicity profile, regardless of which one you started with. If the myelosuppression is prohibitive, there is much less myelosuppression with abemaciclib. If they start with abemaciclib and they're really struggling with the GI toxicity, and much less GI toxicity with palbo and ribociclib. So I think that does give us an option to adjust therapy based on toxicity rather than stopping therapy that seems to be effective. It also gives us a way of potentially selecting a first agent based on the toxicity profile. I haven't experienced this yet, but I could imagine if you said we had somebody who has had radiation to their entire pelvis and lumbosacral spine for palliative intent because of painful bone lesions. So their baseline blood counts because of that are a little iffy, and that makes you a bit squeamish about palbo or ribib because of myelosuppression, that might be someone for whom abemaciclib as a preferential first agent might make a whole lot of sense for them.
Kathy, have you used ribociclib and any comments on it? I guess there's a potential issue in terms of QT and I think LFTs.
So I used ribociclib in some of their initial clinical trials, Neil. I hate having to get EKGs, quite honestly. So I haven't used it as part of standard practice since it's been approved. That is partly just habit. We and my nurses had a lot more experience with palbociclib. I think other than that difference in needing to look for QT issues with ribociclib, its activity and its other toxicities look very similar. So I certainly couldn't fault someone who says we had a lot of experience with ribo and I'm very comfortable with that. My nurses are very comfortable with that. I don't see any reason for them to change that practice either.
Layla, any other questions?
So with the CDK4/6 inhibitors, palbociclib or ribociclib would be similar. How frequently do you encounter significant anemia or thrombocytopenia?
So thrombocytopenia, in my experience and in the clinical trial data, has been less common. Mm-hmm. Anemia gets a little bit tricky because anemia tends to take longer to become clinically apparent. So we tend to see anemia more as a later toxicity. That often tends to be in the people who are responding. So they're continuing therapy for a longer period of time. I certainly can't think of anybody for whom we've stopped therapy or have needed to give them transfusions because of anemia. I have a few folks for whom the myelosuppression required more dose modifications than the clinical trial data would have allowed. So I have a couple of folks who are at a 75 milligram dose of palbo for 2 weeks, and then they have 2 weeks off because that is all their blood counts are able to tolerate. Some folks might say that those are folks where you might think about switching to abemaciclib, which would be quite reasonable, except they're responding and doing well. Mm-hmm. And I don't see any reason to mess with that success for them right now.
So let's move on. And now that we kind of fleshed out a lot of general issues that really apply to a lot of these patients, we can sort of pick up the pace a little bit and just focus on, you know, one or two questions for each one of the remaining patients.
All right. So this patient is a 57-year-old woman who initially was diagnosed with localized breast cancer in 2005. And she subsequently developed a local recurrence on her skin only right at her mastectomy incision in 2013. She was treated initially with adjuvant chemotherapy and adjuvant endocrine therapy. And then once she was discovered to have metastatic disease, she received capecitabine for a year, followed by navalbine for again about a year, and then was placed on everolimus and exemestane for again, well, this time 6 months, and then subsequently on fulvestrant and palbociclib. And she did very well on that last combination of fulvestrant and palbociclib for about 2 years. And her disease on her skin really came down quite significantly to the point that it was a few small flat nodules on her skin. And then eventually those nodules started to grow. We did try some topical therapies, including cryotherapy, but this was not successful in limiting her disease. And then I tried capecitabine again, since she had responded previously, and there was a very long interval where she was maintained on endocrine therapy. She developed hand-foot syndrome as well as progression on her chest wall. Then very suddenly, this picture of her disease changed, and instead of a few small nodules on her chest wall, she rapidly developed a splotchy blanching erythema that quickly spread across her contralateral chest wall. So at that point, this was clear progression. We biopsied the new chest wall lesions, which really were flat areas of erythema at the time, and it was confirmed to be breast carcinoma, this time triple negative. So at that point, I placed her on weekly paclitaxel, and even after her initial dose, she had a significant clinical improvement on the skin.
And what's her current situation?
So currently, she's a few weeks into the weekly paclitaxel. She's tolerating it well. She does have some common side effects associated with the chemotherapy. When her disease really changed, I did send Foundation One testing, and I received the results just yesterday, so I shared them with her today with Kathy, which was interesting. So this patient actually had a PIK3CA mutation discovered on her Foundation One testing.
So, Kathy, you've been hearing about PIK3 mutations for a long time. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what it means. So what does it mean, and what might it mean for this patient?
Well, so for this lady, it could mean a couple of things. The PIK3CA mutations are fairly commonly seen as a mechanism of resistance to endocrine therapy. It is also the most common recurring mutation that's been identified in triple-negative breast cancers. Now, she had initially ER-positive disease with this long natural history and long periods of disease control on hormone therapy. Her most recent biopsy is triple-negative. So whether this is a mutation that her tumor has had during the time it was hormone sensitive, or whether this is something that arose as it lost the estrogen receptor expression, I don't think we know. For this lady right now, she's responding really well to the paclitaxel and is tolerating it quite well. So it's not something that we would immediately suggest a change in her therapy for, but there are several PI3 kinase inhibitors that are currently in clinical trials. So it does give the potential for some targeted therapy options in a trial setting for her at the time of subsequent progression.
So it's always difficult to try to figure out how, you know, drugs that are just in development, what they might offer your patient. You know, I can remember early stories when T-DM1 was not approved, and I would hear people, including you, Kathy, talking about patients they had on trials, and you would hear those stories and you go, well, that thing ought to be in practice, like, soon. And then other times, you don't really know what you're hearing, you know? Where do PI3 kinase inhibitors, I can't say I've heard a lot of great cases where people got it by themselves and, you know, had ibrutinib-like responsive type things. Is there anything there that looks that encouraging?
No, but maybe will be my answer. So I think it's been disappointing, certainly in the laboratory setting and looking at pathology series. It is a commonly found mutation. The drugs that inhibit that protein are quite potent inhibitors. It's the sort of thing that felt like it ought to work, and where we had great hopes that it might be effective as monotherapy and in patients with ER-positive disease in combination with hormone therapy. Those initial phase 3 trials, at least in the hormone setting, either were frankly negative, that the combination was not more effective, or there was only a quite modest improvement, but at the expense of significant toxicity. So I think that your impression that I'm just not hearing a lot of enthusiasm for those results is because of those clinical trial data. One of my scientific colleagues has looked at PI3 kinase inhibitors preclinically in the setting of triple negative disease, specifically to ask, if this is so common and these drugs inhibit this growth factor, why doesn't it work? And has identified a common escape pathway, or sort of the whack-a-mole equivalent of, if you inhibit PIK3CA, what pops up? So we've just launched a clinical trial looking at dual inhibition on the basis of that new scientific understanding. Now, hopefully, this will let us take much greater advantage of these agents. But this very first phase 1 trial just started. We've just enrolled the first 2 patients in cohort 1. So I don't know yet if this will be the great thing you'll be hearing about these drugs in the future, or if this will be another great idea that, when put to the test in real-life patients in the clinic, is not as successful as we hope.
Just to clarify, though, I know there are sort of like, quote, pan PI3 kinase inhibitors and others that are different. Is there a way to sort of look at them more globally?
So we know that, like a lot of receptors, there are different isoforms that have different tissue specificities and different downstream effects. And a lot of question about, can we use that to either develop a specific inhibitor of one or the other isoform, or would a pan inhibitor be more effective? There are some real toxicity issues here. These are common signaling pathways. They have a function in healthy, normal cells as well. So this is a little bit trickier to take advantage of than something like HER2, where this is not commonly signaling in most healthy cells, but is unique to the tumor. These pathways have real functions in healthy cells. So while pan inhibitors might be more effective, there is also the real potential that they might be more toxic. The toxicity issues have particularly been hyperglycemia, hypertriglyceridemia, and the consequences of those things for many patients. Also, for a subset of patients, some mental health psychiatric toxicities with significant exacerbation of depression, even to the point of suicide in some patients. So toxicity will always need to be carefully evaluated with these agents.
So do I understand that this lady just has chest wall disease? Does she have disease anywhere else?
She has only chest wall disease, skin-only disease.
And how much of a palliative problem has this been? How concerned are you about the future for her? I don't know how many patients you have in your practice like this with just chest wall disease.
A couple. In her case, currently, it's not a palliative issue. She is not having pain, bleeding, or discomfort related to this, thankfully. But that certainly is a big concern of mine in the future for her. So currently, even with the progression across her contralateral chest wall, it's not really painful to her. It's not causing any local effects. She did say that she can feel it almost like an itching or a sensation. She's aware of it, but at this point in time, it's not causing major problems. But that is a big concern in the future.
Kathy, any comment on that syndrome or that situation? Anything you've seen that helps locally, like electron beam or any hyperthermia, any local thing, anything to help palliate these patients?
So we've tried all of those things. And I think the challenge is often that the disease itself is frequently much more extensive than what the clinical evaluation suggests it might be. And I think this lady is a great example of that. I've also seen the chest wall disease in a couple of different varieties. There are some that develop really indurated, weepy, messy lesions that often break through the skin, lose the epithelial coverage, and become a real topical nightmare to manage. That does not seem to be the case with this lady's disease. And what she describes is much more just flat spreading erythema with almost a sort of shingles, prodromal, burny, itchy sensation that she gets as the erythema starts to progress. I think part of that sense that it's more extensive is why often our local therapies might control the disease where a radiation oncologist is aiming the electrons or where we put the topical therapies, but we're kind of chasing it across the chest wall and around the bend because we're not able to see or control the full extent of the disease.
Anything else you want to ask about or bring up, Layla, about this patient?
Maybe not specific for this patient, but for this type of chest wall disease, have you ever seen any great benefit to a surgical approach to try to resect or clear the skin? Who would you consider that for?
So I have sent certainly patients who have very isolated chest wall disease that appears resectable for resection and then radiation if they've not previously had radiation. If it's really an isolated nodule, then that sometimes can provide long-term control. With this more extensive infiltrating, we've often not done that. And the times that I've done that, unfortunately, it has not been very successful. They've often had recurrent disease in the area or just on the other side of the incision or the other side of the skin graft. And I think those experiences over the years have made me less enthusiastic about the sort of heroic surgical approaches that we used to try.
Anything that we know biologically about these very unusual, but definitely there are patients out there where they just seem to have this persistent disease in the chest wall. This patient actually had a you know, an NGS assay, but has there ever been an attempt to sort of, or even any theories about why you see this?
So there have been a couple of attempts, but only with very small numbers. And real questions about should this sort of phenomena be studied along with patients who have primary inflammatory breast cancer? Or is this sort of secondarily inflammatory response? Because if you saw her skin that she had now extending over the chest wall at the time of initial diagnosis, you would say, ah, inflammatory disease. But I don't think we have nearly enough samples and really detailed molecular studies to know, is this phenomenon, secondarily skin involvement and spreading in that way, biologically distinct from de novo inflammatory disease? Or is the key driving molecular factors, whatever they might be, present primarily in some and acquired as part of resistance to therapy or natural history in others? We are starting to see more focused investigation both in laboratory models and in clinical samples in patients with de novo inflammatory disease. And we're starting to see some focused clinical trials specifically for people with skin and chest wall disease that I think will give us those insights in the future.
Any other questions you have, Layla?
So a little bit different from this particular patient, but I have a few patients in my practice who have had more of what you're describing, this very extremely aggressive inflammatory picture in the skin of the chest wall where you can almost see it marching across the chest. And it seems to be a completely different disease than other types of breast cancer. And the few cases I've had so far have been very resistant to chemotherapy. And so you answer part of it, but what can be done for these patients? Or in the community, is there any way that their information and their story can contribute to discovering what is different about them?
So I think actually the most important way from the community standpoint that those patients can contribute is actually biopsying their tumors, subjecting them to the NGS testing to understand that. So as we get more and more of those samples, we can begin to study them as a somewhat unique group, certainly clinically a unique group. I fear that they're going to be pathologically more than one unique group. You know, de novo inflammatory, while it has a unique clinical appearance, we see all of the same disease molecular phenotypes in the clinical appearance of inflammatory. So we're actually going to be having a focused think tank meeting at the AACR meeting about inflammatory disease. And one of the first questions is sort of a conceptual one. Should we think of this disease as first ER positive and then secondarily it's inflammatory? Or should we think of it first as inflammatory disease is the big category and it can be ER positive or HER2 positive? And I'm honestly not sure we know which of those really predominates in the primary setting. But I think it's a relevant question for this sort of chest wall marching skin involvement in the metastatic setting as well.
I got to say, you know, for some reason, I kind of was flashing a little bit on immune parameters, like what you see in terms of tumor mutation burden or something with these patients, because, you know, it does seem that, you know, the fact that they get it just in one localized area, like why would that be? Is there some immune correlation? I don't know.
Well, so the Translational Breast Cancer Research Consortium actually has just activated a trial specifically for patients with chest wall disease. For this trial, they can have other systemic disease, so it does not have to be chest wall disease in isolation, but they need to have chest wall disease as a component of their treatment. That study is looking at a combination of chemotherapy and an immune checkpoint inhibitor. The rationale for that trial is partly wondering, as you just were, Neil, is there a unique immune phenotype that might be relevant to these patients who have chest wall and skin involvement? It's also partly pragmatic that to understand this, we need to be able to get serial tumor biopsies. And that's a whole lot easier to do in patients with skin involvement than other organ involvement.
So why don't we go on and talk about the next patient?
So this patient, again, is very interesting to me. So she's now 61 years old. She was initially diagnosed with breast cancer 20 years ago when she was 40 years old. And at that time, she had initially a lumpectomy, ended up going to mastectomy because of margins. She did receive chemotherapy. I don't have the details of that. And then she took tamoxifen. She was only able to take tamoxifen for 1 year and then discontinued because of severe side effects. So after that, she did well for nearly 20 years. And then she self-palpated a small supraclavicular lymph node that led to full diagnostic workup. And she was found to have metastatic breast cancer. And she had metastases to her supraclavicular nodes, mediastinal area as well, that was encasing some of her pulmonary vessels. So we biopsied and found that it was still hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, and I initially started her on letrozole. Once we finally got confirmation of her receptor status, I prescribed palbociclib. And she's a patient who we had difficulty obtaining the palbociclib because of insurance problems and then other issues with the patient assistance program. So in the first 3 months, she actually did not have the palbociclib for the entire period of time. I got a follow-up scan on her 3 months in, and she had progression of disease in all of these nodal areas that were involved. So in her case, because she had not responded on letrozole alone and because the palbociclib was a little spotty during that three-month period, I switched her to fulvestrin and continued on the palbociclib. And she now has been doing well on this regimen for about 6 months. We've had two sets of scans that have shown improvement and good response to this.
So I guess she's currently stable then on those two drugs?
Yes, she's currently stable on fulvestrin and palbociclib, and she's tolerating it quite well also.
So Kathy, any thoughts about this patient?
You know, she was a fascinating lady to talk to. She had really, I think some would hear her experience of the toxicity with tamoxifen and say, really, it didn't sound that bad. She did not describe significant musculoskeletal toxicity. She didn't describe horrible hot flashes. She wasn't worried about blood clots. She just did not like how she felt. Felt a bit in a fog, that she just was not herself and just couldn't imagine continuing to live that way. So I think she, in some ways, is a really good example of listening to patients and hearing their concerns and thinking about what other options for therapy might we have, even if their toxicity to us might not sound like it's that severe. She is currently doing quite well with her therapy. She is working full-time, has a quite active life, actually came to be part of this program because she said, I want to be an example to people that you can have the metastatic disease and still be doing all of these things and be doing well. And that this is not, I forget how she phrased it, but it's not all good news, certainly, but her experience in many ways has been much more positive than what she expected. And she wants to share that. So she reaches out to other patients in the waiting room, mm-hmm. to other folks in her workplace and in her church and in her community to try to be that inspiration to them that you can live with this disease and you can live well with this disease for at least some time. And when you have that opportunity, you ought to take advantage of it.
Any questions you have about her, Layla?
Well, she's so interesting to me because this is a very late relapse. 20 years after her initial diagnosis, she was found to have metastatic recurrence, and she only took tamoxifen for 1 year. So I really wonder what's going on there. Is this something that a longer duration of tamoxifen would have delayed or prevented? She did so well for so long after only 1 year of tamoxifen. What do you make of that?
I think we have so much to learn about tumor dormancy. There is really very little data in people when you have this very long interval. Her disease was there. Is it really that it grows so slowly that it's had a constant growth rate that entire time? Had it really remained dormant, as in not growing, just sort of suspended in animation, if that was the case, what happened that mm-hmm. triggered it to start to grow? When the disease is below our limit of detecting clinically, it's very hard to study that phenomena to understand exactly what happened. particularly when you hear this long interval and only a very brief duration of hormone therapy, I think it has all of us thinking like, ugh, if we could only have seen her then and had some way of making tamoxifen more acceptable and more successful for her, switching her to other hormone therapy. Because it sure feels like if she could have only gotten more hormone therapy, maybe this would have never happened, or it would have been pushed another 10 or 15 years in the future. It may also be that if she had taken tamoxifen for the full 5 years, she still would have felt the same note at exactly the same time. That's also equally possible. But I think whenever we see this combination of long interval and brief therapy, it's hard for it not to feel in some ways like a missed opportunity.
So actually, I was thinking about, you know, the work that was done by Craig Jordan on tamoxifen like a million years ago. And I remember there was this thing about the fact that when you stop tamoxifen, you get like a little anti-tumor kick or something. And that was actually part of the efficacy. And the fact that in the overview, you saw these delayed benefits. And there's always been this sort of weird thing about timing and tamoxifen. Mm-hmm.
Well, tamoxifen is a weird drug. It is a partial agonist, partial antagonist. We also saw largely from Craig's work that, at least in the laboratory, if you maintained cells in a very low estrogen state for a very long time, they then become hypersensitive to estrogen. So it was not so much that they lost sensitivity, but they became super sensitive. And that may have allowed the partial agonist activity of tamoxifen to actually become stimulatory, so that when you then stopped the tamoxifen, you were essentially withdrawing estrogen as a reason for that tamoxifen withdrawal response. It's the same explanation in some ways for why high-dose estrogen might sometimes be effective in those patients. I think those are the sort of things that are somewhat easier to model in laboratory systems where you have a genetically similar cell population treated in the same way, followed exquisitely with serial assays, and you can track exactly when things are shifting. That's a lot harder to do in our patients.
Anything else you want to ask about this patient, Layla?
Well, just a few weeks ago, this patient who is very active, she's really at the center of her family and, you know, works full time and does lead a very active life. She fell into this period of significant fatigue to the point where she was actually spending 20 hours a day in bed due to fatigue. And I was really worried about her, worried about progression or other things. But before changing anything, I had her meet with our behavioral oncology counselor and discuss her mood and depression as well as her medications. And ultimately, we recommended that she focus more on her diet and take in better nutrition and more physical activity. And today when she came in, she was like a new person. She really had that spark and that energy back again with no change in her cancer-directed treatment.
So to say, I was really impressed by that because she described this several week episode to me where there was clearly a dramatic change in her sense of well-being, her functional status. I think all of us would have seen this vibrant woman come in dragging and saying, I'm spending 20 hours a day in bed, and have been very worried that her disease was progressing and immediately changing to more aggressive therapy. So I applaud not following that immediate gut response, getting the data to show her disease is not progressing, and then thinking further about what else could be happening with this woman that has this same physical effect with her, and getting her the support and the help and the behavioral intervention that she needs. I think the impact of supportive counseling, regular sleep hygiene, regular healthy diet, physical activity is under-recognized, and that those interventions are often underutilized in a busy practice. And she has clearly benefited from that, and it has allowed her to get back to feeling really robustly well and back to a healthy lifestyle while still on appropriate therapy that's working for her.
That's really fascinating. And Layla, you said the behavioral oncology counselor. Is that somebody like in your practice, or what's their background?
Yes, so we have nurse practitioners and psychologists, as well as previously a psychiatrist, who have a specific behavioral oncology program where we can send our patients who are struggling with depression, anxiety, fear of recurrence, or cancer-related fatigue, and they support us in helping to manage those symptoms. So that's an excellent resource we have. They prescribe medication and they do counseling as well.
That's really interesting. But it's interesting that this woman had such a dramatic, you know, outcome. What do you think it was that they recommended? Was it the whole package, or was there something in particular that you think made a big difference to her?
I think it was the whole package, and I think the nutritional and physical activity component of it was the most beneficial.
Yeah, and that makes sense to me, actually. When you were talking about it, I could actually relate to it. All right, let's hear about this last patient.
This last patient is a very special lady. So she was originally diagnosed with breast cancer in 1995, and at that time had a stage 3C breast cancer. She had 19 of 19 lymph nodes involved, and because of the year she was diagnosed and the extent of her disease, she was recommended by 3 different oncologists to undergo a stem cell transplant. And she told us in detail about her experience of that, which was quite...
Just say she's not a fan.
I mean, a lot of people don't know about those days. That was a long time ago. But people believed it worked.
So she went through all of that treatment at the time. And then 6 years later, she had a metastatic recurrence in her spine, underwent radiation, was started on tamoxifen in 2001, and since that time has been on some form of active treatment for her metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer. She was on anastrozole and zoledronic acid. She's been on fulvestrant. She's been on letrozole. She's been on capecitabine, actually a few different times, back on tamoxifen, back on fulvestrant. And then in 2013, she went on everolimus and exemestane. She was on that treatment for 3 years, and then subsequently, when she progressed, was transitioned to fulvestrant and palbociclib. So she remained on that treatment only for 6 months and then progressed. So at that point, given her history of progression after so many years and so many lines of endocrine therapy, I tried to treat her with capecitabine again, given that she had tolerated it in the past and there was a long interval where she was back on endocrine therapy. Unfortunately, at this point, she is now 73 years old. She's relatively active and independent, but she did not tolerate the capecitabine well at all. And after one cycle, ended up in the hospital with pneumonia, was hospitalized for over a week, and then was in rehab for 4 weeks afterwards. And that was a major, major setback to her functionality and her independence. So once she recovered and returned home and regained her strength, we had a break for a while, and then I started her back on letrozole. Well, unfortunately, she progressed on the next set of scans on the letrozole, and we discussed in detail whether or not it was the right thing to try chemotherapy. And she and I both agreed that chemotherapy would not be a good choice for her. We focused our discussions more on quality of life and her independence and minimizing the toxicity of treatment.
So, Kathy, we haven't talked too much about everolimus, and it's interesting that this lady had such a great response to it. Actually, when you think back, when the trials first came out, I mean, they had pretty impressive results, but a lot of people really got turned off by the side effects, particularly the mucositis, the threat of pneumonitis. What's it like, Kathy, given exemestane and everolimus today? How do you find it? Do you use preventive mouthwash?
So I think this is definitely one where we would do things differently for someone starting that therapy today than we would have done a couple of years ago. And unfortunately, many of us, if we have started someone on a therapy and your first couple of patients on a new therapy really struggle with significant toxicity, you get a little gun shy and a little reluctant to use that again. And she's actually been on a couple of agents where I think we see that lesson. That certainly was the case with capecitabine, with the original FDA-approved overdose of patients, and realizing we needed to adjust the dose, pay much more attention to patient education and early dose reductions. And with that, for many of our patients, it is much more tolerable. I think the same is true for everolimus. And particularly the stomatitis, for most patients, if they're really going to run into early acute toxicities, it's the stomatitis, and the patients who really struggle tend to develop that quite early. So our initial strategy was to see patients at 2 weeks on therapy so that if they were beginning to have issues, we could stop the drug, let them recover, start at a lower dose. More recently, we've seen data using a prophylactic steroid mouthwash that dramatically reduces the incidence of severe stomatitis, reduces the incidence of dose reduction. It's less clear to me that dose reduction actually hampered the activity, but it certainly reduced the toxicity experience, allows patients to continue therapy with much less toxicity burden. And I think hopefully it will get people revisiting the activity of this drug, reincorporating it into their management strategy of patients with that dexamethasone mouthwash, because it really can be an active drug. I think we all have patients like this for whom it seems to work phenomenally well for a very long time. Unfortunately, we don't have a way to select them up front, which would be a huge bonus for us. But I think it's a great example of, with oral therapy, that learning curve and developing really effective strategies to minimize the toxicity can really open up options for therapy that we really had kind of soured on.
So, Layla, this lady was on the exemestane everolimus for 3 years. How did she do tolerability-wise? Any issues at all?
She did well. She did very well. That was before I was her oncologist, but she was able to stay on it. She did not have significant issues with mouth sores or any other symptoms.
Any questions you have for Kathy about this case or anything you'd like to hear her discuss?
She's a really lovely person, and she's very clear now on her priorities and quality of life. I would imagine I may find that she's progressing on this combination soon. Are there any other endocrine strategies that you would suggest for a patient like this?
So, you know, having met this lady, she is a fascinating lady, and understanding her social situation, I think, is really important to thinking about her care. She is now 73. She lives alone. She did not describe children, close family who are nearby supporting her. So end-of-life discussions and appropriate care for her at the end of her life is a little bit trickier. There's not an obvious plan of, I'm going to move in with my daughter, or my son and his family are going to come live with me. That doesn't make those discussions any less important. I think in some ways it means they need to start even earlier, because negotiating some of those things and understanding her wishes might not be as simple. While she's doing okay at home, she comes off to me as a bit frail. I wouldn't be enthusiastic about giving her chemotherapy. I don't think it's a good match for her disease with this long, slowly progressive, long natural history. It is not a good match for chemo. She doesn't look like a good match for chemo. I don't think she wants chemo.
She would not accept
chemo. Quite honestly, in talking about it. She's not had any of the progestational agents. That'd be one option of something she's not had. She's not had abemaciclib that has some monotherapy activity, still with some GI toxicity. I think the question for her is not going to be so much what therapy should she have, but should she have more therapy?
Mm-hmm.
More therapy will bring some toxicity burden, even if it's not chemo. It also brings more clinic visits and monitoring. I got the sense that she knows she's nearing mm-hmm. the end of her life. I don't know if that means she's going to get another therapy before she's there, but I think she knows that she's reaching the end of what we medically have to offer her. And I really get the sense that she's pretty mm-hmm. comfortable that that's where she is. I almost got the sense that she wasn't so sure she was going to get back home after being in the hospital and being in rehab for 4 weeks, and she's delighted mm-hmm. to be back home and be independent and able to do that.
Yeah, we've been having those discussions over the course of the past 6 months mm-hmm. about some of the therapies and so forth. But her attitude right now is, as long as I can keep going independently, yeah. that's, you know, her main goal.
And I wouldn't argue with her about that. I think she's also an excellent example of how end-of-life discussions are not a single point in time decision. It really works best as an ongoing discussion that's focused on the goals the patient has and what options we have and what really seems like the best way forward now. So I wouldn't feel badly about switching her to another hormone therapy. I wouldn't feel badly about not switching her to mm-hmm. another hormone therapy, depending on how those discussions with her goes.
Kathy, do you ever use high-dose estrogen therapy? And it was, you know, a long time ago that was actually Tamoxifen was compared to it. Are there situations that you would actually use it? And if so, like what kind of preparation?
So I have used high-dose estrogen. In fact, some of the most glorious hormone responses I have been in folks with high-dose estrogen. I've actually sent 2 patients on high-dose estrogen for endometrial ablation to control the endometrial bleeding that was stimulated by their high-dose estrogen because it was working so well for their cancer that we just needed to take care of this severe bleeding so they could continue therapy. The patients in whom it has been the most effective tended to be patients who had very long natural histories, who had long periods of disease control on anti-estrogen therapies, particularly on aromatase inhibitors, where you've really created a very low estrogen state. It has been less effective in people with visceral disease, although I've sometimes still tried it, compared to those with just soft tissue or bone-only involvement. For most folks, it's well-tolerated. It can cause some mild nausea, certainly can increase the risk of thromboembolic disease, so I'd be a little reluctant in someone who'd had previous blood clots. And for folks with an intact uterus, can certainly cause a vaginal bleeding. That, in my mind, is not a reason not to do it. It's just something that patients need to know about. There was a randomized phase 2 trial that Matt Ellis led several years ago that compared really high dose estrogen, the doses we used to use when we couldn't get DES anymore, to sort of lower dose high dose estrogen. So the lower dose appeared to be just as effective, but less toxic. So that dosing strategy was 2 milligrams of just plain old estradiol 3 times a day. So I definitely have used that strategy in some patients.
I mean, would that be, you said a patient with a long natural history, this lady's had metastatic disease 16, 17 years.
Yeah.
Would that be a consideration for her?
It certainly would be an option in your hormone therapy armamentarium for her.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty and to our community-based oncologists, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Visiting Professors Breast Cancer Edition.